Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 21st of October. Very nice to have you with us. Thrill always to do a show and have people listen. It's part of the equation. And without you, it's really not that much fun. We thank you very much for being here. We have a lot to talk about. We have a wonderful panel and really cool people to talk about what's making news today, and we will get to those stories in just a moment. Before we do that, I would like to introduce everybody. Reminder, you can be a part of the discussion as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we welcome your thoughts and letters. Let's go to our group this morning. Recently retired president of Siena University, former New York congressman, writer, and analyst, Chris Gibson is with us. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, Joe. Great to be back.
New book, Spirit of Philadelphia, still out there talking about that. That's good. Excellent. Thank you for being here. Professor emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and author of A Liberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia, currently teaching in the Middlebury Graduate School for Russian. Alexander Mihailovich, good morning. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks.
Wonderful to have you here. The Empire Report's J.P. Miller is here. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. Thank you for having me, Joe.
J.P. does it all. He's a panelist. He's a board member. He's on. He's on it. And we thank you very much for all.
I'm wearing the sweatshirt, too.
Yeah, you do. You're hawking the brand. That's good. Associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College, Catherine Tan, is with us as well. Good morning, Catherine. How are
you? Good morning.
So nice to have you all here. All right. So we have a lot to talk about because there is I feel like I say this every day, and I think it's true, but there's a lot going on. For what is happening in the world. If you look at most newspapers today on the front pages, not that a lot of people do that anymore, but if you were to go to newspapers and look at the front pages, you're going to see a lot of pictures of a part of the White House being demolished. Mm-hmm. So that, and if a picture could tell 1,000 words, that certainly is one of them. But we will start in a bit more... on ground that is not reliant on as many pictures and sort of gasps as you see the claws going after the White House that you have known and recognized for decades. We will start in Russia. We touched on the story yesterday. We really didn't get to it, and it was really from a conversation we had on Friday with Alexander, who is here, and of what would happen with Thursday or Friday, with Zelensky going to the White House and how that would work out. And so more details came out yesterday about this. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is rallying the support of his European partners after a bruising meeting with President Donald Trump in which he was told to make concessions to end the war or risk facing destruction at the hands of Russia. In a tense meeting at the White House on Friday, Trump tossed aside maps of the front line and urged Kyiv to concede its entire Donbas region to Russia to clinch a deal, according to people familiar with the exchange who spoke on the condition of anonymity to share details of sensitive diplomacy. He said, "Putin will destroy you if you don't agree now," one of the people said. Zelensky had his maps and everything, and he was explaining it to him, but Trump wanted nothing to do with that. Trump listened, but was not responsive to the Ukrainian message. It was pretty much like, "No, look, guys, you can't possibly win back any territory. There is nothing we can do to save you. You should try to give diplomacy another chance." In remarks released Monday, Zelensky said it was very important that the Europeans have a unified position with Kyiv and that they would also address the United States in various formats. I would love to know what that means fully. He told reporters he also planned to meet with European allies this week. As European leaders issue proclamations of support for Zelensky, his White House disappointment is set to dominate diplomatic talks this week, including a European Union summit on Thursday. That from the Washington Post. Alexander.
So, actually, the last time when I was here, I think it was last Wednesday.
That was
prior to Trump's phone call with Putin, which lasted 2 hours. And apparently, you know, as of last Wednesday, Trump had promised provisionally Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. Now, Tomahawk missiles have already been on the table, the provision of them to Ukraine for its self-defense from the European Union, which bought $20 billion worth of them from the United States to provide to Ukraine. So that seems to be going forward. One thing about the Tomahawk missiles is there are certain technical specifications which make their implementation difficult. You need special launchers. They're actually designed to be launched primarily from the sea, and that's not really an option for the Ukrainian Navy at the moment. You need these special so-called Trifon launchers for them to be easily launched from the ground. So there are all sorts of different moving parts about implementing them that needs to happen before they're actually used by the Ukrainian military. Now, Trump, was very friendly to the whole idea of providing these missiles to Ukraine until this two-hour conversation where Putin essentially love-bombed him. All right, this is the only, excuse me, pun intended, I'm afraid, because this is, this is typical of this current administration, which has been around for over 20 years in the Russian Federation, which is that it uses a certain kind of form of informational aggression. And Trump fell for it. And it's as if all those conversations that had happened prior to that simply didn't occur. So all of a sudden, Trump is going back to what he and Vance insisted in the February meeting in the Oval Office to Zelensky, is that he give up territory, that he engage in a so-called swap of territory. Now, here I have to sort of point out one thing. It's not a swap. It's not a barter. It's utterly asymmetrical and unilateral. Ukraine would be giving up its territory. It is not coveting any territory within the Russian Federation, right?
But in exchange to end the war, though. So they're getting something, right?
No, this is true. But specifically, Trump was saying, and Putin is saying, a swap of territories. And there is no territory on the Russian Federation side that Ukraine wants. So,
well, technically, there are some small areas in the Kharkiv and I think it's Sumy.
Yes.
Areas that it's small.
But that's still formally a part of Ukraine.
Exactly. I see your point there. But when he says land swap, he's talking about areas where, Russia would cede that territory.
Okay.
So I'm not supportive of the entire arc.
They cannot cede territory that is not theirs.
Yeah.
All right. You're defining, I'm not saying you, but the way this is being framed now is if another country goes into a sovereign nation and simply takes it over militarily, then it becomes de facto its territory. No. This is absurd. If you make that assumption, then, the entire rule book or the whole notion of territorial sovereignty flies straight out the window. And the other aspect of this is that Trump is repeating, talking points about the conflict now as of Friday that are very clearly coming from Russian propaganda. And there's specifically this one specific statistic that he's been trotting out to Zelensky within the last few days, which is that, Russia already owns 78% of Donbass. And actually, it's more than 78%, it's 88%. But that additional 10% is something that the Russian Federation government is not publicizing to its population. You won't find it on the Russian media that Russian citizens have access to readily, because that 10% came at an enormous human cost. 80,000 Russian soldiers were killed. Over 150,000 were badly wounded. And so they're really not keen to sort of publicize that. But Trump is repeating something that is coming straight from the Russian media, right? So this is, you know, disconcerting to say the least.
Do we know what, how do I ask this? Do we know what the Trump administration really stands for, or is it who talked to him last?
I think it's essentially who talked to him last, you know, and I think that, you know, that's clearly what's going on right now. I mean, his attention span is not very long, it's not very wide, and so he's very impressionable. All of the things he said to Zelensky are coming, you know, from very recent ways of talking about this problem, from Putin's foreign policy team and from the Russian state-controlled media in general.
So he's been teetering. Well, Trump has been teetering since what he met with Putin. Well, long before that. But he met with Putin in Alaska earlier in the summer. And then at that point, he came out I think at that point he had suggested that Ukraine cede land. Mm-hmm. And then he met with European leaders because they were trying to rein him mm-hmm. back. And then he was like, okay, well, we should continue supporting mm-hmm. Ukraine. And then now we're seeing this teetering again. Mm-hmm. But even with the teetering, who he saw last, consistently he has demonstrated greater enthusiasm for what Putin has to offer. Mm-hmm. And I actually don't know very much about this at all, but in his last conversation with Putin, there was, I guess, some talk about some kind of tunnel or constructing some kind of tunnel between Alaska and Russia. And so there are all these other deals. There are all these other
it's an interesting idea.
Deals that are also, you know, I mean, it sounds like a total fantasy.
It will be
fantasy.
Run by Metro Nora. Chris Gibson.
Yeah. So, look, I mean, clearly Putin communicated to President Trump about those Tomahawk missiles, and he is rightfully concerned. I think there's an opportunity here. You know, Trump wants to work diplomacy. I published a piece about 2.5 years ago called The Future of Europe, and the plan essentially has Russia giving back all territory back to Ukraine, including Crimea. Mm-hmm. And in return, Russia and Ukraine are brought into NATO. And I think this at least ought to be put on the table. He has leverage, President Trump. Number one, the Tomahawks. Clearly, Putin doesn't want to see an escalation where all of his cities are vulnerable. And also, frankly, the oligarchs. Because the opportunity for Russia and Ukraine to both get brought into both the European Union and NATO would be something that would be attractive to those that are looking to make money. I have briefed this plan to a few people. I know that folks say, how can you trust Putin? Well, I don't. But you can make ways to have this verified. And I'll also point out that our country worked with Stalin. Mm. So Putin's a bad guy. Is he worse than Stalin? I don't know about that. So Alex, I just wanted to say that to your point, I agree with you. I don't think that you know, Zelensky's in a position to give up that territory, nor should he.
Yeah.
But I think we should look for creative ways mm-hmm. to address or at least call his bluff, call Putin's bluff as to what he said were the underlying conditions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyways.
So I think that, you know, Chris, just to sort of build on your point, I'm very glad that you raised the issue of NATO membership for the Russian Federation, because this is actually a really interesting idea. Yeah. And Gorbachev first broached that, you know, as an idea. I mean, he was kind of sort of in the late 80s, early 90s, he was kind of brainstorming this problem already, you know, during a part of that time when he was no longer, you know, president. I mean, and he said, well, either the Russian Federation could join NATO, or we could have a new security organization that is kind of a bridge between Asia and Europe. Something like the original organization CETO, the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, which, you know, eventually folded. And so then Putin took up this idea in the early 2000s, you know. So it's an interesting idea, you know. And I think that, in fact, there are any number of reasons, you know, for thinking that NATO and the Russian Federation have certain common interests, you know. So, okay, so far so good. But here's the thing. Putin is not concerned about the Tomahawks being used against population centers. He's concerned about a continuing barrage by Ukraine of energy resource centers within the Russian center, within the Russian Federation. This is what Ukraine has been doing. It's been hitting those, and as a result, the Russian ruble has plummeted, and the Russian economy is doing very poorly. So he does not want to see a continuation of that occurring. Another factor, this is the last thing I'll say, I don't mean to sort of, you know, hog the stage, but another factor in all this is the recent decision by the European Council, of the, which is the executive, essentially, of the European Union, this is still something that is in kind of the proposal stages, but it seems like it's going to pass, is that as of 2028, the European Union will no longer use any gas coming from the Russian Federation or oil, right? And this includes even liquefied gas, so natural gas. So this would be a huge hit to the Russian economy because it is burdened by the energy resource curse, you know.
I have a question real quick. So right now
actually,
there are sanctions.
Do you mind holding your question?
Yeah.
If you'll remember it, right?
I'll remember it.
All right. Please hold on to it.
Okay.
For dear life.
It's not a very good one, but all right.
All right. No, that's, I'm sure it is great. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll get to the question. We'll continue our conversation. We'll welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will continue after this news break from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this 21st day of October. It is 33 minutes past 9 o'clock. We have been discussing Trump pressuring Volodymyr Zelensky over war. Europe expresses support in looking at this. So we want to, we've been discussing it. Catherine had a clarifying question, I believe, for Alex.
Yeah.
And then we haven't heard from JP yet. Mm. And then we'll get into the letters because they're already starting to pile up.
Okay, Alex.
Yeah.
So you said 28 that the sanctions, that Europe will pull out of buying fuel from Russia,
yeah.
Right? And so don't we have sanctions right now that, you know, that Europe shouldn't be buying fuel from Russia? And if not, why don't we? And, like, why can't this be something introduced right now to apply some pressure?
Right. So that's an excellent question because there are sanctions that also touch upon energy resources, but the level of reliance is simply too high on Russian oil and gas in the European Union. So it's been much reduced, but it hasn't been ruled out altogether. So the percentages are dramatically down. But the Czech Republic, for example, which until the invasion of Ukraine in 2022, the full-scale invasion in 2022, had 60% of its gas was coming from the Russian Federation. Now it's much less. I think it's maybe 28%, something like that. Mm-hmm. But you cannot, you know, scale back. You know, when you have those levels of reliance, you cannot, you know, overnight cut them off because that's just simply not feasible.
What other countries could they look to purchase from?
Well, this is an excellent question. There's been a lot of brainstorming about this. One is, you know, liquefied natural gas from Qatar. You know, but it's very expensive. Liquefied natural gas in general is much more expensive than having it, you know, brought in directly through a pipeline. Increasing forms of green energy, you know. The energy resources are kind of a whole separate line item from the sanctions. So that's, you know. And that's been widely recognized and practiced.
JP?
I don't have a lot to add to what's already been said, except that I've been listening a little bit to the 60 Minutes interview with Jared Kushner from last week, and he kind of defined in that interview the president's foreign policy philosophy, which is he called it pragmatic realism. Mm. And he said that a lot of times the United States gets caught up in values over interests, and that the president focuses more on interests than values. And so my view on this is that the president wants a deal to happen. He's not on the side of the Russians. He's not on the side of the Ukrainians. He simply wants something to happen, and he's trying to get the two sides together. And he will view that as a victory for him, much like he viewed the a victory last week of getting those 20 Israeli hostages home. Mm. And what happens afterwards, the long term, what happens in the region and how things interact, that's a far, far distant cry from simply having a deal done.
No, that's certainly true.
I think you're right that, well, Trump, with anything, is quite short-sighted. We were just talking about how quickly he teeters depending on who he spoke to last. And if Ukraine were to give up Donbas, like, that's a large part of their economy, isn't it? Like, much of their industry is there.
What's left of their heavy industry, the lion's share of it is located in Donbas.
So what would happen to them as a country if they were to give up that region?
Well,
it would be
a
question.
Shell of its former self, put it this way. The other thing is that the main industrial, I'm going to put it, the main economic resource of Ukraine is agriculture. And that has already been undercut by the presence of the motion detector mines that the Russian Federation has planted in many of the fields. And so many of those areas are going to be unusable in the near future, because those mines are incredibly difficult to defuse. Hmm. So taking away the Donbas region would be an economically, deleterious to Ukraine. There's no question about that.
Right. So they don't really have much of a choice but try to hold that region down.
Yeah, to hold the region down. There's also the other question, the other element of this, and just to sort of JP to expand on what you said, on the pragmatics and the political realism of the Trump administration. They're really not interested in many of the local, like the ground level details of things. An example of this last Friday was Trump's repeated confusing of Donbas with Donetsk. Donetsk is a part of Donbas. It's a little bit more than one third of that territory. But he repeatedly confused the two. He said, "Well, we have to give Donetsk to the Russian Federation, no Donbas," So back and forth, shuttling between those two points. And as a result, some important details were getting lost in the shuffle. The most prominent of them, I think, was Zaporizhia and Kherson. Putin represented to Trump that he was going to relinquish his interest in those, except for certain parts of those two territories. So it's not as if he's completely giving up his interests, even in the areas outside of Donbas.
We have several letters. I want to get to those. And we'll take a break in just a few moments. Paula says the guiding principle for Trump and the administration is whatever is in the best interest of Trump and his businesses. He's absolutely inclined to appease Putin for some deep, dark secrets, which probably revolve around money. Will we hear the word tomahawks again?
I doubt it.
Yeah. Russ says the diplomatic problem in Ukraine is essentially the result of a peculiar slant in the view of Mr. Trump. Ukraine wants a democratic government on the European model. Trump sees government as the power of bosses over their subordinates. Oh, JP, I think I think I just killed the letter. Hold on. It's all a careful game, folks. All right, I'll get to the next letter. I apologize. Paul, do we know when Trump and Putin first met, or how long has Putin been grooming Trump? that from Paul? Is that a fair question?
I think it was 2013. It was when they first met very briefly in Moscow.
I have a maybe a silly question. Do you think when they speak that Putin speaks in English?
No.
No.
No. I mean, his English is pretty good, but I think that he always uses a translator.
All right. And
and Trump doesn't speak in Russian.
Trump doesn't even speak English.
Would that be something?
That would be interesting. Yeah.
And then let's see, does Trump really need to say the words peace for our time? For you and others to equate his position to appeasing a war mongering murderous dictator? That from Steve. Anyone want to say anything about that? No? Okay, we move on. And finally, we will go to Ellen, who says, Planet Money last week did a podcast on a shadow fleet of hundreds of tankers ferrying sanctioned oil out of Russia with near impunity. The ships are transforming the global oil market and fueling the war in Ukraine, the financial and environmental disaster waiting to happen. The oil is still flowing. That from Ellen. Do we know about that?
I don't know about that specifically, but, you know, the tankers coming from the Russian Federation have played a very important role in terms of cementing, you know, sort of unorthodox relations with other countries, you know, in terms of supplying oil under the table and also engaging in limited military missions, you know, sabotaging pipelines primarily.
What if someone asked Trump to swap Alaska if Russia made an incursion there and claimed it is now part of Russia? That's what he's asking Ukraine and Zelensky to do. Europe has decreased their LNG purchases to 12%, working to zero by January 2027, although the official date is January 2028. So 30% of Russia's current sales will go away in 14 months and further hit their oil-fed war machine.
Well, of course, Alaska was a part of Russia until 1867, when it sold, when Russia sold Alaska to the United States, you know, to fund a crisis it had in its national treasury.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We welcome you and thank you very much for being here. I want to talk a little bit. We touched on this. Well, we talked a lot about yesterday about the Gaza truce and the weekend that put some of that into question. Now the White House seems to be doing whatever they can to hold on to this agreement. Vice President J.D. Vance arrived in Tel Aviv on Tuesday for meetings with Israel's leaders. Steve Witkoff is there as well. Israel and Hamas agreed this month to a truce in their two-year war, a deal based on parts of a plan outlined by President Trump. On October 13th, the Palestinian armed group handed over 20 Israeli hostages it was still holding in Gaza, while Israel released nearly 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees in exchange. And again, this is the Trump administration rushing to shore up the fragile ceasefire deal in Gaza, though less than 2 weeks old. The ceasefire is already under strain. Analysts say that Vance's trip to Israel, which is set to last until Thursday, was intended to send a warning to both Israel and Hamas not to undermine the truce. Mr. Vance is traveling and is expected. He later traveled south to the city. He was take two on this. After landing in Israel, the vice president joined Steve Witkoff, Mr. Trump's Mideast envoy, and Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, for a nearly two-hour lunch at the airport. Mr. Witkoff and Mr. Kushner were instrumental in brokering the ceasefire deal. This is the story you were referencing earlier on 60 Minutes. This update from the New York Times. Thoughts?
My thoughts are, I have not listened to the whole 60 Minutes interview, but my thoughts are is that the administration would do well to realize that the Israelis and the Palestinians are going to be fighting for another 1,000 years, and they got the 20 hostages home. They should put up the mission accomplished banner behind, you know, on the deck of the on the deck of the destroyer and go home and call it a day. The more they get involved in this and the more that they take ownership for this, my view is that they're going to be dragged into something that they have no control over.
Alexander.
Well, I don't know how many of you have read the 20-point peace agreement. It has a distinct aspirational character. Put it this way, I mean, it's basically very hopeful, but there are many details that are vague. Hamas giving up its weaponry. The term that is used in regard to the weaponry is military, so it de facto excludes weaponry that's used for internal security. So already, as of last week, there were some shootings, of the Hamas local security force against perceived traitors against Hamas who are Palestinian within Gaza. So I think that it's not much of an agreement. I mean, I think that the fact that the large scale killing has stopped, that Gazans are not dying by the scores is a good thing, but that I'm afraid that the conflict will fester because of this particular agreement having such a non-binding character.
I mean, I believe there was an agreement earlier in the year, and then shortly after, Israel broke its end of the deal. And, it's really discouraging to, have everyone celebrating this ceasefire deal. And then a week later, the attack started up again. So, I mean, I have no idea what it would take for people to feel a sense of security and to actually experience real sense of security when, both sides are not really holding up their part. But even more so, Israel just has so much more ammunition and power to discontinue the destruction, right? And so it's what is a ceasefire deal?
So it's hard to imagine this coming off from phase one to phase two. A couple points on this is it's actually in Hamas's interest, particularly to have a long intermission between phase one and phase two. They're trying to consolidate power. They claim collaboration among some of the folks, and they're trying to take care of that. And also getting some of the international aid in relieves some of the pressure on them. I can't see them giving up their arms, nor even accepting some governing body with Blair and Trump. And then, of course, that situation is untenable to Netanyahu's government. So it's hard to see this moving beyond into a phase two. But as I said, this intermission right now, if you call it, is actually at least in Hamas's interest, and at least to get the hostages back was in the Netanyahu government's interest. JP mentions what it mean for domestic politics and even international relations for the United States if they continue to be heavily engage diplomatically here. I'm not sure that there's a way to get off this tiger, but I do want to say that, Alex raised this 20 points. My first reaction when I heard all this is, oh my goodness, this sounds a lot like 14 points. And how'd that end here in America? Not too well. So it's going to be curious to see. Of course, you know, the other thing is undergirding all this is the heavy aspiration for a Nobel Peace Prize. So, you know, there's a lot of interest for President Trump to try to get this moving from phase one to phase two. And, you know, there is some overlapping interests, but they seem to be really negated by the entrenched positions that Hamas and Israel have taken publicly heretofore. So, yeah, I mean, I think right now the best we can hope for is that this intermission allows for another breakthrough, because I don't see the 20-point plan really, at least as it's initially promulgated. And as you point out, it is intentionally vague. But nevertheless, without some kind of annex, I don't see how we move from phase one to phase two.
The other aspect of this, of course, is that the 20 points, you know, inherits many of the Biden, you know, talking points, you know, about, you know, the way the conflict needs to be resolved. And that's actually not a good thing, because the Biden policy was deeply confused. And both administrations, the Biden administration and the Trump administration, continued to give significant caches of weaponry to the Israeli Defense Force to bombard Gaza with. And this, among other things, is going to stick in the craw of any number of people, you know, on the Nobel Committee and in Europe in general, about the idea of Trump or any American president involved in this conflict receiving a Nobel Prize. I just don't see it. I mean, we're already seeing a kind of non-military form of reprisal with the Israel allowing only a fraction of the humanitarian aid that was promised to Gaza. And this apparently is kind of in response to some of these localized conflicts as of the last few days that Hamas has been involved in, and in the fact that Hamas is still not giving up its weaponry. So I'm concerned that we're going to be kind of stuck in this sort of phase 1.3 or something like that.
There was an article in the New York Times last night about how the White House is very concerned of the activities of Benjamin Netanyahu and what of sort of keeping him on track and concerned of what he would do to go against this agreement. Is anything that the U.S. is sending Vance? I mean, is any of that seem plausible to work as far as lessening those concerns over Netanyahu?
I think that, you know, what both President Trump and Vice President as his messenger here is to remind the Prime Minister that his, you know, dicey political situation to a degree was shored up. And I say that both internally, but also the pressure externally that they were receiving, given the starvation of people in Gaza. So I think that, you know, President Trump is probably reminding Netanyahu, how does it feel to stand trial? You know, imagine yourself in that circumstance. And he's trying to keep him walking the straight line here, which, you know, I think he'll do for a period of time. I don't think his heart's really in to the 20 points. And we've all heard his communications. Now I'm talking about Prime Minister Netanyahu. He's never fully said he's behind those 20 points. You know, he wanted to get, he was under pressure to get those hostages back. He has now. He likes the idea of some kind of ambiguous communication that could lead to something that he calls total victory. But once you dial down into the details of that 20 points, it's meant to be an agreement. Where everybody gets something. And Trump has even said as much. So, you know, again, going from phase one to phase two is going to be very difficult. Yeah, the longer the intermission goes, maybe something can come. But it's going to have – we're going to have to see more leadership from the Arab countries who did play a role in getting Hamas to utterly – or to at least come to the table. So we'll see on that.
Anybody else? All right. We will take a break here and we'll be back and hit a lot of other subjects, much more to discuss on the program this morning, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We did get this note from David, who says, "People, please, there is no ceasefire. Israel got their hostages back, and literally the next day, Israel was again killing civilians. It was pie in the sky, a mission accomplished moment. But make no mistake, there is no ceasefire, no peace. Netanyahu has no interest in peace or dealing with the Gaza issue. He wants Palestinians gone. He wants the land. End of story. And yes, I'm Jewish." That from David. Mr. Gibson says D. Trump has already moved on to his next debacle. That from Diane. Then what about disarming the Israelis? It's not like Hamas is the only terrorist organization. Just ask 70,000 dead Palestinians. And then we go to Mickey. Did Israel break the ceasefire, or did Hamas attack the militia in Rafah, resulting in Israel retaliating? I'm referencing an interview with Realign for Palestine, who said this: "How about Hamas killing their own citizens? Doesn't seem like Israel broke the ceasefire." That from Mickey. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Thrilled to have you with us. Also with us this morning, Chris Gibson, recently retired president of Siena University, former New York congressman, writer, and analyst. And it's great to have Chris Gibson here, as always. Alexander Mihailovich is professor emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and currently teaching in the Russian school at Middlebury. And J.P. Miller of the Empire Report is here, and Catherine Tan, associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College. And welcome all. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Just as we were coming back in from break, we were looking at some of the disturbing images coming out of Portland, Oregon. And what we learned yesterday is that the Trump administration can proceed with deploying National Guard troops to Portland under a ruling Monday by a U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit that dismissed a lower court's contention that protests in the city have been largely peaceful and under control. The appellate ruling lifted a temporary block on the deployment of Oregon soldiers by Judge Karen Emmergut of the Federal District Court for the District of Oregon. It was not immediately clear whether the order also allowed President Trump to use National Guard soldiers from other states, as he suggested he might do. Lawyers for Oregon and the city of Portland immediately asked the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit for what's known as a rehearing, an appeal before the Chief Circuit Judge and 10 randomly selected judges. On Monday afternoon, a Ninth Circuit judge requested a vote among active members of the appeals court on whether to hold the hearing. Lawyers for both sides have until midnight Wednesday to file their arguments. For now, a second temporary restraining order issued by the judge, which covered all federalized National Guard troops, not just those from Oregon, is still in effect, but likely not for long. The Ninth Circuit judges wrote in their order that they believe the two restraining orders rise and fall together, quote unquote, and federal lawyers asked the judge on Monday evening to stay or to remove the second. So Monday's ruling opened the door to some federal troops being stationed at an Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in South Portland that has been the site of street protests since June. We obviously are waiting for the courts on this, and we'll see, as it has happened in other places. But you look at the images that are coming out, certainly from, for example, an ICE detention center in Portland, Oregon, and what is happening, and does seem otherworldly, doesn't it?
Well, the big picture is that this is part of a plan to normalize military presence in everyday life. You know, it started, I believe, in Los Angeles to quell protests there, and then in D.C. because of homeless populations and violence, even though rates were declining. I mean, it doesn't mean that, you know, these are not issues in D.C., but, you know, it certainly did not justify the military presence that was brought in, the National Guard that was brought in. And now it is in Portland. And it's outrageous because this is an attack on our First Amendment rights. This is an effort to normalize having, you know, troops around when there is no justification. And after 30 days, we're going to see them move on to another city and come up with some flimsy excuse for being there. I mean, if you look at the videos that are coming out and, you know, out of Portland and the actual reporting on, you know, the so-called violence, there it doesn't justify this sort of aggressive maneuver that we're seeing right now. And, you know, I think it's like after 30 days, they act, you know, they have to petition or go through some formal process. But after this, I imagine it'll move on to another city and it's going to go from city to city. And, you know, at some point, I really hope we don't get weathered by this. And I hope people continue to be outraged by what's going on.
Well, I'll be very curious to see how this ultimately pans out. From a constitutional perspective, it's pretty close to a jump ball here. And, you know, here are some factors. Well, first of all, this district judge is actually a judge that President Trump appointed in his first term. So I think that is at least interesting. You know, the work that she did is she held a hearing so that she could look at the facts, understanding how well the collaboration was going on between the local law enforcement officials and the federal officers, the law enforcement officers who were there. She ultimately determined that they were working together and there wasn't a need for an exogenous or, in this case, you know, a National Guard force to come in. So this appeals court, it appears, has leaned heavily on the 1827 U.S. Supreme Court case, the Martin case, which does in fact say that on matters of these, like essentially tantamount to the Insurrection Act, but deploying the National Guard for law and order, for enforcing the law, insurrection, these type of things, the president shall be the sole authority to declare. That is the precedent from 1827. It's complicated, though, because in 1932, the Sterling decision was handed down, and that Sterling decision said, yes, but these are all reviewable. And so you see the mention of the body camera, stuff like this, reviewable. And if the president is seen as not acting in good faith, then, in fact, this can be overturned. And then finally, the 32 case also said that even if the guard is there, they still have to honor the constitutional rights. So, you know, I don't think we're done with this. That was a 2-1, as was mentioned in your preview, Joe. We're going to see if the 10 panel at the appellate level is going to raise it and see if that changes the 2-1 vote. But I'd just be curious to see how this all comes. I think if this were just one city, I'd actually give it 55-45 for the Trump administration. They would probably come down on Martin on 1827. But because this has been done in a series of cities, and actually I think they may even introduce some other words from President Trump where he talked about, let's go after A, B, and C, one of them, that's A, B, and C, one of them being Comey. I mean, I think that that's going to also come down to potentially targeting or bad faith, and that may even get introduced in this matter to say that, well, you know, yes, maybe 1827 Martin case that the president is the commander in chief and can deploy. However, it appears that they're targeting cities based on partisan complexion. I'm curious to see how this all plays out, because I could see it going either way. There are arguments to be made in both directions.
Well, of course, this is in bad faith, because he's, like you said, he's going after cities that are known to be, you know, Democrat cities, and he has already made threats to come after Chicago, it's absurd that this is, I don't know, I imagine that there would be a lot more outrage across the country as this is slowly creeping, you know, through the nation.
Well, yeah, I mean, to your point, I think the two strongest points that to come down on the 32 precedent, the Sterling case, is one, the bad faith, and then also how fastidious the district court judge was, a Trump appointee, by the way, in terms of pairwising the action in the law, the intent. She made a very diligent work of it. So I think those bode towards the overturning of the appellate of this 2-1 decision. But, you know, they're going to come back again. The thing about the protective principle is it's not been upheld by the Supreme Court. This is sort of a new dimension. The last time we saw a president use the National Guard over the objection of a governor was 1965. It was the Selma March. That was before this whole development. That was the last time it happened. So, yeah, I mean, it's. I'll be curious to see how this all goes.
Oh, no. And I was just going to quickly say, if you juxtapose this, I mean, if this is really about keeping peace and order, like if you juxtapose this to how Trump pardoned January Sixers, then what are we doing here? Right. Like that action does not really comport with what's going on right now.
You know, one last thing, and I know others want to jump in, is, you know, philosophically, as a founding principles conservative, I have issues with, you know, just putting federalized National Guard troops in all these cities. The policing function, the policing responsibility is explicitly clear in the Constitution that that is for the states. This was part of the co-sovereignty that we had in our federalism principle at the outset. So just the precedent of sending guard troops, this is different. You know, when you look at 1965, when you look at 1992, after the Rodney King riots in L.A., those were explicit reactions to a specific stimuli. In this case, it's broader. And, you know, I'm just concerned. I don't like the precedent here of a president unilaterally doing this. I mean, this should really always be in cooperation with a local governor. And if there's something systemic, I want to see the people's representatives to go on record debating and taking votes on record before a president uses executive action to do these kind of things.
Well, the Martin and the Sterling decisions in the 19th century, even the Martin, you know, requires or calls for some kind of evidentiary basis for, you know, presidential intervention. And the fact of the matter is, in Portland, the primary organization responsible for gathering evidence about, a breakdown of law and order on the streets is the police force and law enforcement. And in Portland, they skew politically, in a general sort of way, very conservative. But even they have said that there is no need for this, you know, for a military presence on the streets of Portland. So then the question becomes, well, where is this coming from? Like, what is the demonstrable need, you know, for this kind of information, this sort of intervention? And there is none.
I kind of wonder why it's still these lower courts that are going back and forth on this, and why the Supreme Court hasn't acted. Do you think that they will act? And if they do, which way do you think they'll come down on?
Yeah, I mean, so like I said, I've read pretty widely about this, but I think if it was just one city, I actually think the protective principle might be upheld for the first time at the Supreme Court level. But I think given the fact it's multiple cities, I think it's going to be hard for the Supreme Court to side with this. I think the fact that they haven't touched it at the moment shows the fact that politically they're inclined to support the unitary executive. They're inclined to support law and order. But I think Star Diocese, I think they're concerned about what they say in a constitutional perspective. And I think they would like to see like Ted Cruz's and the Rand Pauls of the world who are expressing concern. Mm. Both of them are expressing concern, different kind of concerns. Mm. Rand Paul's been very clear on this from the start. Ted Cruz has been on a little bit lately. They're hoping that maybe politically this can get sort of simmered down before they have to make a decision. But, you know, and Alex just mentioned, you know, these thresholds that come with Martin 1827. True. I think the Supreme Court will have to contort themselves if they ultimately uphold this. But we'll see.
I mean, one thing, Caroline Leavitt last week, this came up in last week's program that I was on in the general discussion. She said the quiet part out loud. She said, people in Portland are protesting against the Trump administration. We have to, in our administration, rethink the kinds of fundings we're going to provide for the state and the city. You know, so it's pure retaliation on an ideological level. And, you know, she didn't even include the whole matter of law and order in discussing this. So that already is kind of a giveaway, I think.
Also, it to your point, Catherine alluded to this, but to your point, Chris, I mean, there hasn't been a firm reason as to why the troops have been in the various cities. What we heard originally going into Washington was about cleaning up. I mean, we got into the homeless, we got into violence, and ultimately it seems to be about immigration.
Well, so Joe, actually, I have seen they have invoked protective principle in Portland. However, in L.A., President Trump was explicitly asked about the Insurrection Act. He was intentionally vague. He didn't want to respond because he'd like it to be something very broad where he just basically by fiat can do what he wants. So he doesn't want to have to invoke something specific because that could tie him down later. But with regard to Portland, they're talking about the federal law enforcement officials were not adequately protected. That's being contested. And as just pointed out, Alex pointed out, that the local police believe that there is good cooperation between local and federal officials. And the district judge, the Trump-appointed district judge, documented some of that. So, you know, this is the next step, obviously, is going to be this broader panel of the appellate. And then, you know, the Supreme Court's, I think, is kind of hoping this gets resolved before they have to speak on it.
All right. Anything else? We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. And we will move on to other topics. My computer is taking a moment just to just to figure things out, much like I am. See this, JP? Look, nothing moves.
It's thinking, Joe.
I know. Here, let me go use my background device.
That's a quicker thinker.
Or my backup device, I should say. And we go to, all the technology in the world. And I learned yesterday that every website is run by Amazon. So there we go. I didn't know that either, but we learn these things. Okay, so let's go to... the other, basically, I wanted to, a couple topics, but I want to give them their due. I think we can do this one in the 5 minute times, in the 5 minute time that we have. And that is James Comey asking for a dismissal. This from the Washington Post, that Comey's lawyers moved to dismiss the case. First battle in the prosecution, the former FBI chief argues his prosecution is a result of Trump's personal spite and should be barred. He asked a federal judge on Monday to dismiss the criminal case against him, calling it a vindictive prosecution and a direct extension of President Donald Trump's long-running personal animosity. In court filings, Comey's attorneys accused the president of personally instigating the case on facially flawed charges that Comey lied to Congress when several career prosecutors refused to proceed, citing insufficient evidence, the attorneys wrote. Trump installed a loyalist as U.S. attorney to ensure that a case would be filed. In a second motion Monday, Comey's defense team challenged the legitimacy of that appointment, saying Trump's pick for the interim U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia is serving unlawfully in that role. Again, that from the Washington Post. Does Jim Comey have a case?
Well, legally, you can't, like, go after and punish. Well, Trump cannot go after and punish people for, you know, like, personal reasons, right? And they can't go after just political enemies. And similar to our previous discussion on, you know, sending troops to Portland and other cities, this is vindictive. This is personal. He's, similar to how he's going after Letitia James. I don't know. I personally don't really like Comey, but I think he's going to hopefully make it out of here as unscathed as possible, because this is not legal.
It's not legal. But there's another aspect of this is, you know, kind of Trump's mercurial, you know, character and sort of impulsiveness and the way he takes offense, even against people who are his supporters. Mm-hmm. Eric Siebert, the previous attorney general, the one, you know, prior to Lindsey Halligan, you know, who's suing this case against Comey, was actually a Trump appointee and a Trump supporter. And but he did not see any validity in this case against Comey, which is why he was essentially fired by Trump, or he resigned, you know, under pressure by Trump. The details of Lindsey Halligan being improperly appointed have to do with the bylaws of the Eastern District of Virginia, which state that a president can only appoint an interim attorney general, and it's on the state level at a time, and that if that interim attorney general is then, you know, released from their responsibility, it's up to the Eastern District Court of Virginia to appoint a temporary attorney general until a replacement can be announced. Trump did not do that, right? In other words, he enacted two appointments in a row, which is against the bylaws of the state of Virginia in terms of its court system. It's going to be interesting to see if that sticks, you know, but that seems to be really a separate matter.
The current judge, I think, that they appealed to is Judge Nachmanoff. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but Nachmanoff is a Biden appointee. But I believe that Nachmanoff said earlier this month he intends to direct Comey's challenge to Halligan's appointment to a judge outside of the Eastern District of Virginia. And when the judge does that, who will the next judge be in line?
Yeah.
And who decides who that judge is?
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. Well, I presume the Eastern District. I don't know. But it could be that this whole proceeding could get drawn out considerably because of this, you know, the murkiness of Lindsey Halligan's appointment.
If she hasn't been, like, confirmed, though, how has she gotten this far with the indictment?
Good question.
They gave her a desk.
Yeah. Don't we have, like, guardrails or anything against these?
We have 30 seconds. Go ahead.
It goes to what Alex says, is that you can have a temporary person holding the office, but even the Supreme Court has affirmed what Alex is saying, that you get one. You don't get two. So it's a complication for the Trump administration right now. And that's even above and beyond the issue of politically targeted words.
I'm going to hold you there. Yeah. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Chris Gibson, Alexander Mihailovich, J.P. Miller, and Catherine Tan all with us. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We talked about this yesterday, and I said I am fascinated, I am obsessed, I cannot get enough information on the break-in at the Louvre. Oh my goodness! This is just it's a crazy, crazy story with a lot of things that I don't quite understand. But wow! So two things. One, as I said, we talked about it yesterday. What I think was important that what happened throughout the day yesterday, after we were off the air, is there actually a timeline was established as to how things unfolded in that morning. Truck arrived at the Apollo Gallery outside of the Louvre. If you were, for example, if for those of you who are familiar with the building or even the pictures of the building, if you're on the Seine River, there is a window overlooking the Seine, and it's a second floor window, and that's the window they went into the Apollo Gallery. If you were to continue to walk down that on the outside of the building, you would eventually see the big sculpture and triangle outside that so many people associate with the Louvre. 9:30, the truck arrives. The thieves break into the gallery through the second floor window, and then by 9:38, they escape on two high-powered scooters. Now, here's what we know about this, which is, first of all, they break into the window, and when they break into the window, the alarms go off. When they break into the first display case, an alarm goes off. When they break into the second display case, the alarm goes off. The Louvre had been open for 30 minutes. Police receive a call from a witness in central Paris reporting suspicious individuals outside the Louvre. Two men in motorcycle helmets arrive on Yamaha T-Max scooters, while another two men wearing yellow and orange vests sit inside a truck with a lifting platform. Local police are immediately dispatched. 9:34, after securing the area with traffic cones, the thieves deploy the lift, and two men climb a ladder to the second floor balcony using using an angle grinder. I'm not exactly sure what an angle grinder is, but they did use them as weapons against the guards when they were in the gallery. So does anyone know what an angle grinder is? Okay. I don't know. It's probably a common tool. I don't know. Anyway, an angle grinder, which is apparently a cutting and grinding power tool, they used to break the window. Two men wearing yellow vests go through the broken window into the Apollo Gallery. It's one of the most ornate rooms in the Louvre, and it houses the French crown jewels, among other priceless treasures. Then inside, they use the grinder to smash two display cases. They grab nine pieces of jewelry, including tiaras, necklaces, and earrings adorned with sapphires, emeralds, and diamonds worn by the 19th century queens of France. The smashed display case triggers the first internal alarm. Five museum staff members in the gallery implement a security protocol and alert law enforcement. By 9:38, with the priceless treasures in hand, the thieves flee through the broken window and descend on the ladder. On the other side of the Apollo Gallery, a tour guide is about to lead a group through the long room when he hears what sounds like stomping on a window. Museum staff shout at visitors to evacuate. A security officer manages to stop the thieves from setting fire to their truck, but they escape along the banks of the Seine on the two Yamaha T-Max scooters. What we know about the truck, so when they went down the ladder, they were going to then take all of the stuff that they had besides the jewels, shove it into the truck, and then burn the truck up. Well, they didn't get to do that. That was a flaw in the plan. They also dropped the crown. they were in their haste to escape. They dropped the crown. 1,354 diamonds and 56 emeralds, and it was damaged. And obviously, in the haste to escape, and then a ways down the road, a yellow vest is found, apparently dropped by one of the thieves. So right now, as far as evidence, besides what is in place within the gallery of the Louvre, you have the truck that was supposed to burn up, you have the damaged crown, and then you also have the yellow vest. And the fact that nobody was injured in any of this also, I think, is worth noting that is fairly interesting. The other thing, and before we hand this over to our group just to talk about it and sort of just be gobsmacked by it, is the whole thing took 7 minutes. So yesterday and the day before, but I believe today as well, the Louvre has put up on their website, the Louvre will remain closed today for exceptional reasons.
What could it be?
If ever there were exceptional reasons, it sounds like this. So they now have a full list of what was there. And there's also great concern as to what is the future of these objects, because there are experts who say, well, the thieves may have already melted down the metals and recut the stones if they were looking to get cash as quickly as possible. So finding the chances as time goes on, the further time goes on, the chances of finding the jewels intact is relatively more and more distant.
Well, while
that was beautiful,
thank you.
That was awesome.
Yeah, lots of drama.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't obviously approve of any of this. There is something really romantic about a jewel heist. We need this right now. We need this.
Jumping onto the mopeds, going down the side of the Seine. I mean, it's awful. It's horrible. It's a crime. I mean, yes, they should go away forever, but it is kind of cool.
Did anybody else start thinking about that movie with Jesse Eisenberg and Isla Fisher and Woody Harrelson?
Yes. Yeah. Now you see it. Now you don't. Yeah, that's the one.
And you know, with all the people dying in the world, and all the horrible news we've been discussing during this program so far, I don't know. This kind of brightened up my day a little bit. They're not my jewels, so I don't have a personal attachment to them. But I do have a tiara fact. So one of the pieces stolen.
not as exciting as if you said, I have a tiara, but go ahead.
Well, in my backpack. So one of the concerns, as you mentioned, is that they are going to, remove these stones and then sell it in its parts. And, historians and people in the museum world are saddened by this. I personally don't care. This is not something that is, all that new or particularly heartbreaking. So one of the emerald necklaces that was taken, it actually had a matching tiara. And it was sold in 1953, that the emeralds from that tiara was sold off to Van Cleef. And so there are a bunch of people out there right now, probably wearing one of these stones from the same set, and then they replace it with like turquoise or something. But I just find it very funny that some people have this sort of emotional attachment to preserving the jewels of aristocracy that we don't really.
Or it could be, smash the aristocracy because they're taking apart these beautiful pieces of, you know, jewelry, and, you know, they're selling off the different, you know, elements of it or melting it down. I mean, it seems, apparently, even if you recut some of the stones, there are all sorts of ways in which they could be recognized as coming from, from these original assemblages.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is what some experts in Antwerp say about this. So, interesting that this has been categorized by, you know, the Louvre administration and the French government as commodity theft rather than art theft, which is a whole different, kettle of fish, because, you know, works of art are incredibly difficult to sell. You know, there's almost unless you find a very like an oligarch buyer or someone like that who's only content to see it in their home.
There are very few of them.
And, you know, it strikes me that sociologically it's very confusing, right? You think of the moment the world is in right now, there's at least three things that come to the fore for me. One is this anti-elitist movement, which could find some sympathy in something like this. Mm-hmm. But then there's also the nationalist movement. And they may think, well, that's an affront. And then third, there's a law and order. So they kind of cut in different directions. So it's kind of very curious to me to watch the reporting of this and just to see humans just sort of react to it, where they may align in those three different, arcs, if you will, in the sociological moment we're in.
Again, very romantic.
Yeah,
it doesn't speak much to the security. My goodness gracious!
Yeah, no, that's for sure. I mean, one interesting aspect about the relatively lax character of the security is that it has probably everything to do with allowing people to sort of look up close to these, to some of these artifacts, and this speaks in a kind of a general way, it seems to me, to the democratization of the museum experience, because of course, so many of the paintings in the Louvre, and for example, in the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, these paintings were not originally displayed to be looked up close. And, they were usually hung in horizontal rows, one on top of the other, and in a kind of it just pointed to the status of the owner and the institution, and it was very difficult to see these things up close. But then at a certain point, primarily after the Second World War, you began to see this movement among museums to sort of give these give people ready perceptual access to these incredible artifacts of history, or call it what you will.
You're both talking about the security, and I think that's really interesting because it is remarkable that all of this happened in 7 minutes. But you figure there's at least, let's give them the benefit of the doubt, 3 minutes in the room. That's still a long time for someone within, and I believe it was 7 guards that were in the gallery, of what they were doing. I told this story yesterday. I'll tell it again. A number of years ago, my wife and I were in France. We went to the Louvre. We were walking from Martel over to the Louvre, and we got panhandled, and then I got mugged. And they got my watch, and they got my wedding ring. And apparently, as I was walking into line, I realized that just about everyone else had been taken down as well by these very accomplished thieves. What I thought was fascinating, and I have the picture, I brought it up last night, is in one of the galleries at the Louvre, there is a sign that says, please be aware of crime within the gallery, of pickpocketing and looting, and please also realize that those security guards you may report to are in on the crime. Well, what do you do with that information? So, a number of years ago, I don't know what security protocols have been changed, but you do wonder, and this is it's a fascinating thing to sort of figure out what was going on.
My view is that the outfits were the most brilliant part, because when you think about people robbing a museum, you think of people dressed in black with hoods and all, and there's nothing less offensive or scary than a person in one of those big orange yellow. They look like they're supposed to be there. How could they be harming anything? And they have the video of it today, of those people in those outfits. My view is that was the most brilliant part of their operation.
Well, of course, the yellow vests. I mean, there was an actual labor movement and sort of protest movement, you know, just several years ago in France, the Gilets Jaunes. You know, the yellow vests were basically protesting the increased, you know, cost of living, and it kind of cut across, you know, political lines. And many of them were voting for, you know, the hard right conservative candidate, Marine Le Pen. So there is, you know, a sense of kind of, it's almost as if they're expressing some kind of populist rage. You know, they're signaling it in some ways, being dressed that way.
In the first couple of hours, I was waiting for some kind of statement, you know, like if this was a Robin Hood type of activity. Yes. But we haven't heard it yet.
It has not been the case yet.
And one other thing, the NPR coverage where they interview the French people and they're, you know, upset.
I watched it last night. Yeah.
That's
the nationalism thing.
Yeah. Yeah. People could think of that as entertaining. Not me, but people could think of that.
No, because it's they feel that they're, you know,
national big pride.
I mean, if you look at what we call it in this country, the Smithsonian is America's attic, and you would think of it in some cases, the Louvre being that of France, and to have it. A brazen attack.
Of course,
this.
To JP's point, if you're outside France, that's exactly how you may be
exactly.
React.
Yeah. Hilarity ensues. We'll take a break. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Yes, we're still talking about the Louvre, but we'll change the subject for you. But it's hard because it's really a fun, fascinating thing to talk about. Okay. We want to touch on the White House hitting a roadblock in an effort to get top colleges to agree to this deal. Six of nine universities that were asked to sign an agreement in exchange for funding advantages have rejected the offer. Two said they were open to more discussion. There was a deadline, and that has passed despite strong pressure from the Trump administration, including a call with the White House on Friday. Colleges and universities are largely rejecting the president's offer of preferential treatment for funding in exchange for compliance with his ideological priorities. Six of nine universities offered the deal earlier this month had publicly said no to the White House request by Monday's deadline. On Monday, the University of Arizona and Vanderbilt University did not accept the deal but said they were still open for more discussion. The administration has said it is seeking to make sure the country schools are merit-based, but many universities and higher education advocates said the White House's proposed agreement would undermine the merit-based process currently utilized to award research grants. If only we had a former college president in our midst.
Well, it's just the idea of the federal government, you know, in this case, trying to put a compact together and essentially coercing private entities, including colleges and universities, strikes me as really anathema to founding principles. So on some of the specifics, I mean, just look at – well, let's talk about testing. One of the stipulations was testing. I was part of the effort in Congress to roll back No Child Left Behind on testing. I didn't think the federal government should be mandating this testing. So I'm kind of surprised at the arc that now the federal government's now going to put testing back on. You know, as a college president, I can tell you that – you know, the thing that this really identifies is who's going to need extra help so that they don't attrit. You know, I was explaining to some parents about why it is we went in at Siena with more tutors, more advisors. I said, look, I want to see our attrition rate fall and our graduation rate rise. And I explained how we were doing this. And once I did, the parents were like, we get this. You know, we understand what you're doing. MIT, the fact that MIT was one of the first schools to put testing back in, it didn't surprise me. I actually predicted it because, you know, for MIT, they didn't have a whole wing of help. For people who were struggling, they kind of figured that they would sort that out before you showed up. And so MIT was at a decision. I'm speculating here, but some of the more elite colleges on that level are at a decision point then. Do we go ahead and invest in a whole wing of support to make sure people don't attrit out, or should we just weed them out before they come in? But I don't think this is a federal issue that they should be involved with. You know, the issue on humans who come to the Earth with male genetics, I don't think they should be competing with women because it's a fairness issue. But I don't think that the president, I mean, this is an issue for the NCAA. And if they're not going to take it up, then the people's representatives should debate and take votes on record. We shouldn't have one person in the country making those kind of decisions. So I just principally I have a problem with what's going on here.
Well, letting politics directly influence knowledge production is scary. I think many of us can agree with that. What I'm seeing is, yes, you know, there are a lot of material resources on the line, right? Trump is saying, well, you take the deal and we'll favor you for, you know, funding, grants, stuff like that. And if you don't, then you'll be denied these material resources. And I don't know how enforceable that's actually going to be. I mean, we've seen Harvard push back with some success. But I think the bigger thing that's happening is that this is a symbolic move, right? It is getting universities to swear allegiance to Trump. It is going against progressive thoughts. And, you know, I would say largely this is the larger consequence is like the what this will mean symbolically, culturally, and as we move forward. But one thing that, you know, I keep coming back to is that in the media, in Trump's portrayal of the university or the academy, and in the media's portrayal of the academy, you know, they're painting these spaces as being super progressive, super liberal, when they're on the ground, they're actually not, right? Like, you know, many of us here have worked in universities and colleges. I'm currently a college professor at a pretty, you know, what is by reputation a quite liberal college. But, you know, these spaces are not as, you know, liberal and progressive as people fear them to be, right? And there are reasons why we have things like DEI or DEI initiatives, which is to correct some of the inequities that have, you know, strong historical roots. And, you know, this attempt is going, you know, is imposing, you know, or is aimed to favor conservative thought. And we've seen this already, you know, in many agencies, right? Like early after the inauguration, Trump had released a list of words that federal agencies cannot use. And so we're seeing more of that.
Yeah. We are out of time, and I apologize. No. I'm really sorry. I can't hear from both of you. We'll be back right after this.